We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On today's episode, we have an extended owl post on our recent Star Trek episode. Welcome to Potterversity. On today's episode, we have an extended owl post as listener and regular guest Louise Freeman shares her thoughts on our recent Star Trek episode. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, campus minister and adjunct faculty at Ohio Dominican University, and a collaborator with Katie on all that stuff she named.
There's a lot. We do a lot of collaboration, Emily.
Yeah, we do. It's fun.
It's good. All good stuff. Well, today we have brought back our wonderful Potterversity producer, Lori Beckoff. Welcome back, Lori.
Always a pleasure.
And that's so that she, Emily, and I can talk with Louise Freeman, more about Star Trek Harry Potter connections. And so we are joined today by Dr. Louise Freeman, who is Professor Emerita of Psychology at Mary Baldwin University, as well as a licensed behavior analyst and service provider for special needs individuals. She has written and presented on many aspects of Harry Potter and psychology, as well as on the Cormoran Strike series. Welcome back to the show, Louise.
Well, thank you. It is always such fun to be here with you ladies and to be talking about some of my favorite things and my past and present obsessions. So
wonderful. Well, we always love having you on the show, Louise, and so glad that you could add to our thoughts on the Star Trek Harry Potter connection. You sent us a letter about additional thoughts after listening to that episode, and we thought, well, let's have Louise come back on and explain her thoughts. Just, you know, in your own words. So, Louise, tell us.
Yeah, we were also looking for excuses to do another Star Trek episode.
we really thought we were like, this isn't over.
Thank you for indulging us.
Yeah, it's the tip of the iceberg, really. At the end of that, we were like, we could keep going. So, Louise, tell us first, how did you get into Star Trek and how has it figured in your experiences as a fantasy or sci-fi scholar?
That's a great question. Boy, my Star Trek fandom probably goes back to before some of you on this panel were born. I became a fan in the original series. I was just a baby when it first premiered, so I'm not old enough to have watched it on television in its first run, but I saw it in reruns growing up. I'm talking about the original series now. And I really became a fan, I guess, when I was in high school, which was in 1983, 1984, long about then. So it was around the time, I think, the first Star Trek movie came out in 79, and then Wrath of Khan came out in 82 or something like that, more or less.
I think that's
but
right.
Anyway, those were the movies that were coming out. I remember my high school graduation. We celebrated that after the graduation ceremony. I went with my two best friends because Star Trek III, The Search for Spock premiered that day. And we went to, on the day we were high school graduates, to see.
What a good day.
That's awesome.
So
that sounds like fandom to me for sure.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. My first con I went to when I was a senior in high school, that was Chattacon in Chattanooga, Tennessee, which had, it was all sorts of sci-fi and fantasy, but I was there mainly for the trek at that point. And the other interesting thing, I think it was the second or maybe third date I went on with the man who is now my husband and has been my husband for 35 years, was to a little Star Trek mini convention that was held at the campus of Emory University in the fall of 1984.
That is couple goals.
So,
I love that so
yes,
much,
beautiful
Louise.
stuff.
Yes. So
It's a
we went to
risky
that together,
date.
and that was right after we started dating. It was kind of our first, our.
Did you dress up as characters? I just want to know who you've dressed up as with your
No,
husband.
I certainly not for that con. I think I can't remember if it was that or something. At one point, I like went and bought a like turtleneck blue shirt at Kmart or someplace like that, and hot glued braid to the cuffs, and made myself a little logo thing, and just had a blue shirt as but
Science,
that was the
yes.
extent of my.
Yeah, I could have guessed science for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You guys
Yeah.
just
Oh,
made me
yeah. It
remember
was
something.
definitely Spock was my favorite. I had a little pair of rubber ears that I wore sometimes. So
Oh,
I
look at.
have these ears. These are technically, what are they listed as? Large space ear tips. I bought these to be Dobby for Halloween in like 8th grade. And now I've since reused them to do a Lord of the Rings elf. I did a Galadriel. But I don't think I've actually used them as what I think they're intended to be, which are Vulcan ears. So they're Cool.
multi-purpose ears for
Yeah,
whatever
I don't
fantasy
know if I still
sci-fi
have
needs you
my ear.
have.
Yeah, I don't know if I still have my rubber ears. They might be in a box. I know a few years ago I ran across that shirt I made. Of course, I couldn't fit into it now, but
So I feel like maybe the prevalence of pointed ear characters in sci-fi and fantasy might be something for someone to
All right,
investigate,
yes.
because that's a lot of
Okay, you'll
different
have to do a
characters
whole
that you
show
can.
on pointed ears and the
Like,
significance of pointed
why
ears.
always the pointed ears? Well,
I
Louise.
do also have a pair of pointed ears upstairs. So just to say, just to admit that. I did not bring it to the podcast like Lori
And
did.
they almost always seem to be a sign of wisdom, right? Like,
That's
sure.
right.
Wisdom. Oh, at least like Lord of the Rings elves and Vulcans, like, Hogwarts house elves or Harry Potter house elves definitely have more powerful magic. So, like, it's all in the ears.
Okay, now seriously, people, my husband has pointed ears. So,
So, what is
like
he?
some people
Is he
do.
elf? Is he Vulcan? What's the
I
deal?
think he's a very Tolkienian elf. And
Oh.
my son inherited one is really pronounced, the other is very subtle. And my
So he's
son,
like Spock, he's like half.
my son inherited both. They're both a little less pronounced, but he's smaller too, so they might grow. But yeah, and the first time I saw it, I was like I couldn't take my it's like what who am I out on a date with here? What's
You were
going
into
on? Because he's
it.
also really super coordinated and like he's super athletic and like super he's very gifted in many ways. And so yeah, I'm always kind of like, I married an elf. I married an
Shout
elf.
out to Emily's husband.
Yeah, I
This
know. Sorry.
may be the weirdest tangent we've ever gone
Yeah,
on this
maybe.
podcast. So, okay. So, Louise, tell me, do you think that this early Star Trek fandom had an impact on the way that you approach, for example, the Harry Potter series or other sci-fi fantasy literature that you've gotten interested in over the course of your career?
Oh, yeah, it's really hard to say. I mean, I've never done any scholarship per se. Like, I've never written a paper. I mean, I reviewed a couple, I think, for you guys when you were writing your anthology or editing your anthology, but I've never
Yes.
written any Star Trek scholarship myself or really even read any of it. So I know it's out there, but I can't really say that it's. I don't really see any direct connection. And also between my Star Trek phase and my Harry Potter phase, I had my DC Comics phase. So,
Oh, okay.
which if you, so if you're if you're doing a show about DC Comics and Harry Potter, bring me on for that one. But
All right. Yeah, that'll be I'd have
noted.
to do my
Yeah, no,
research.
but I've never written any I've never like delved into the psychology of Star Trek, although I'm sure others have. But
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff on Star Trek. And you mentioned the anthology that Amy Sturgis and Emily Strand put together. Emily, do you want to remind us the title of that book?
Yeah, I should have announced myself with that title.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's called Star Trek: Essays Exploring the Final Frontier, and it came out with Vernon Press in 2024. I think it
Yeah,
was
it's recent.
2024.
Yeah.
Yeah,
And
it is a recent,
I
very
read it
recent
and reviewed it,
publication.
and it was wow, lots of cool essays in
Thank
there.
you.
So yeah, there is some good Trek scholarship out there for sure.
Yeah.
So Louise, you sent us your thoughts after listening to our Star Trek episode. And your chief theme, I think, was very much kind of revolving around the idea that we get from Harry's scene with Dumbledore at King's Cross Station at the end of Book Seven, where this idea is, that what happens in our heads can also be real, can also be
Yes.
reality. And you had thought of a number of other, like, Trek episodes and kind of stories that explored that idea. And so sh if you would, can you share with us some of your thoughts on those, like head spaces that are also real?
Oh, well, sure. Of course, the first one goes back to the original series, actually the original series pilot, which was called The Cage, with Jeffrey Hunter, Captain Christopher Pike going to Talos IV and encountering those aliens there that can make you have these illusions that are indistinguishable from reality. And of course, that pilot was later remade into a Star Trek proper episode where it was told in flashback. This was one of Spock's early adventures that with Christopher Pike before Kirk became captain, and it was told, and the original footage from the pilot was used as kind of archival footage that when Strike was giving testimony at this hearing and telling of what had happened to them on this mission to Talos IV. But yeah, that's the fundamental themes, and I'm sure anyone who has any familiarity at all with the original Star Trek knows this because it's certainly one of the most famous episodes, and a highly ranked fan favorite episode.
Yeah, so you don't have to
But
worry about spoiling anything for
okay,
anybody, Louise.
no. If it came out in
That's all good.
1969, it's going to get spoiled.
That's pretty
Sorry.
spoiled. Yes.
Yeah, you've had time. Yes.
Right.
69, 66, whenever that was. But anyway. So anyway, the premise is that Captain Pike, Spock's first captain, has been injured in this major accident. He's been basically reduced to having what's comparable to what we would call today locked-in syndrome, where he's conscious and aware, but can't speak or communicate. He's confined to this wheelchair, or this 23rd century version of the wheelchair
He
that.
kind of looks like a Dalek
Yeah,
from the
okay,
show.
yeah. But the only thing he can do is communicate yes and no through this little beeper thing that's on his chest. And so that's all he can say. So Spock basically mutinies and hijacks the Enterprise and wants to take Captain Pike back to this planet that is now forbidden. And in fact, you can get the death penalty for trying to visit this planet, which seems rather backwards for Star Trek universe. I would think they would have done away with the death penalty by then, but
Yeah, they
this is
act like they're so
1966
humane, and
Star
then it's
Trek
like
as
death
opposed to
penalty.
1990s Star Trek, which is of course a bit different itself. But turns out, so on this first adventure, it turns out these aliens had tried to get Pike, kidnap him, basically keep him in this cage and use him to breed a race of slaves for them. They had a woman there who had was a survivor of Starship crash on there years ago, and she was, of course, was very beautiful, and Pike really liked her and everything like that. So they,
That's classic Star Trek.
yes, of course, and
And of course, the camera has to be all like gentle and foggy around a
oh
beautiful woman so that you know she's a beautiful woman.
Lots of
Absolutely.
strings.
So anyway, Pike, manages to thwart them and manages realizes he's in this illusion and realizes that no, my phaser is actually working. If I aim it at their head, I will kill them. even if they're trying to make me believe otherwise, and do you want me to test? And so he figures out what they're doing, and he's confronting. And so the aliens basically release him and said, "No, we see now that your species has a unique hatred of captivity, even when that captivity is pleasant, because of course in this world you could have or wish for anything you want. I mean, this woman can look like anything he wants her to look like. They can have any sort of life they have as long as they're willing to stay in this cage and breed for them."
Right, because the woman wasn't actually beautiful either. She was horribly disfigured from the
Yes,
accident
yes,
that the crash landing, you
yes.
know.
And so for that reason, and of course the aliens, when they had found her, did not know how to put her back together again. So they had just sort of put her back together the way they thought was right, and of course she was horribly disfigured, so she didn't want. So they offered to take her with her when they left, but she just chose to stay there so she could have this illusion of beauty and health. So anyway, what Spock wants to do now that Pike is in this, very extremely disabled condition, is he wants to take him back so he can be with Vina. And so the whole series is basically him explaining why, as he's being court-martialed for mutiny. And anyway, at the end, Pike says, "Yes, I want to go to Talos IV," and the aliens take him back, and Kirk sees Pike and Vina walking off together, in their heads. And so they have this illusion now that they can be together and both be healthy and both can spend the rest of their lives together, enjoying life and enjoying each other in this paradise, even though that, the reality is both of them are severely disabled and confined to wheelchairs or whatever. I mean, Pike, it's far more than being in a wheelchair. Pike literally cannot communicate except from yes and no. He's fully paralyzed. But anyway, and the alien closes it with, Pike has illusion, you have reality. May your way be as pleasant, or something like that, or may you find equal happiness in your own way. So.
Yeah, I find that really interesting. One of the things that you'd said in your comment, Louise, was that, it's sort of like, is it a cage if you are severely disabled, and that is this element that there, and what do we think about that? That this is projected as it's actually a positive thing for somebody who has this level of disability to be able to live in this maybe illusory world.
This also makes
Yeah.
me think of an earlier Dumbledore quote. So you started with the quote from King's Cross. Of course, this is happening inside her head, but why on earth should that mean that it's not real? Makes me also go back to the earlier Dumbledore quote of it does not do to dwell on dreams and forget to live. But if you're in a situation in which your life is severely restricted, are dreams the only reality you can hope for and are a solace and, are going to be the best option? Which also gets me to bigger questions about like disability in both of these series
Oh,
and
yeah.
transhumanism, which I know we've discussed before,
Sure.
but the difference between someone who just wants to live forever, selfishly by killing others, and someone who just wants to live a regular lifespan that would be cut short.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is, the definite message from the menagerie or the cage, is, if you are able-bodied and able to do for yourself, no, it is not good to be locked away. Even if you can have this fantasy life that is everything you ever wanted it. But once your body stops working and your mind is all you have left that is functioning, why not go into this fantasy world and live there? It's very interesting. Two things that struck me. Another thing that was going on in the 1980s, 90s is there were a lot of Star Trek novels being published. And one of them, I do not remember the main story, but there was like a revisit to Talos IV. And at some point, this novel revisited Pike and Vina, who were there. And they were just, enjoying each other's company. They just had a good meal, cooked a meal and eaten it and enjoyed each other's company. And Pike had gotten up to get up to wash the dishes. And Venus said, you don't have to do that. All you have to do is wish them clean and they'll become clean for you. And you don't actually have to do that work of washing them. And Pike says, no, we shouldn't do that. We need to do these types of things for ourselves, even if we don't have to keep ourselves from just, having every bit of work, basically requirements taken away from us. I thought that was sort of an interesting take. But the other thing that I thought of, and this is probably something to put to Emily as our resident theologian here, is this a secular version of, the Christian view of heaven, where your body has died and yet your soul is supposed to now go up and be in this paradise situation. And I mean it's comparable, except that in the Star Trek world this is a completely secular, it's a completely technological paradise, not a quote unquote real paradise.
I think it's such an interesting question because there is so much about Star Trek that seeks to sort of enact what have long been sort of religious ideals, but in a totally secular environment. So, like the kind of post-scarcity, post-poverty, post-crime, post all of these things environment
Post-death
that,
penalty.
yeah, po right, in some circumstances,
Yeah.
unless they need it for the plot. In that, in so many ways, they do seek to enact what in the Middle Ages we called the kingdom of God, this kingdom of justice and peace where you had this one figure who was always just and always merciful and always, who could be relied on for these things, to his reign, his dominion was what, the medieval Christians all wanted. And, some of us still today.
I just have to say
But
it's Dominion.
dominion, I know, right?
Not
I
to be
mean,
confused with Deep Space Nine. Go on.
Deep Space Nine loves the religious language. But yeah, I mean, this ideal, the idea of the internal being, in fact, more real than the external, or more maybe durable, I would say. Not that neither one is less real than the other, either one is less real than the other, but that the internal is more durable than the external is a huge, I mean, it's always been. I mean, it's the basis of the incarnation, right, of Jesus. It's like, God who is this internal figure, we can only connect with God in an internal way. Comes external, for the purposes of leading us to the realization that the internal is that more durable, more it, that the only part of us that's eternal, is the internal part of us. And so this is something that religion has always played with, I think Christianity plays with especially fondly. And I do think that yeah, absolutely. I'm not one to go for analogies. Well, this is exactly like this in this tradition. I'm one to kind of go for these broad sweeping, applications. But it strikes me, this idea of the cage and the prison reminds me of what Tolkien said in his On Fairy Stories essay about, when people say fantasy, they dismiss fantasy as escapism, fantasy, the genre as fairy stories as escapism. He says, well, when you're in a prison, can you really be blamed for wanting to escape? Like, wouldn't any sane person want to escape? And I mean, in his sense, the human condition itself is a prison, because we are limited by this material world. We are faced with our lack of durability, and so wouldn't we want to escape into something else? And I think Star Trek, ironically, for how very staunchly secular it is, so often, it does really give us a very similar opportunity, to escape in our minds to these different places and different scenarios.
Yeah, I think Louise, you also had mentioned, so that those are positive, right? Positives. I guess I was thinking about the Star Trek movie that was the crossover between the original series and the next generation. Was it called Generations?
Generations.
Where they have this this loop,
The Nexus.
the Nexus, and it's almost drug-like. People want it so they can have that fantasy, but it's an escape. It's represented as pretty bad. So it's not represented quite as positively. But I was thinking you mentioned even more negatively, that there's this episode with Chief O'Brien where he is accused of a crime. And so I wondered if you could talk to us a little bit about what you were thinking with that in the
Yeah.
line of this theme.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are really two episodes, one's from The Next Generation, one's from Deep Space Nine, that deal with this another instance of someone basically having this fantasy existence that is completely real to them while they're experiencing it. And then subsequently the memories of it are completely real. And they remember it as if it actually happened to them. So then, like, it's like one is good and one is evil. It's like flip sides of the same coin. So we'll start with the evil one, since that's when you brought up Katie. This is from the episode. It's called Hard Time. It's from Deep Space Nine. Miles O'Brien, the wonderful engineer they have, has, for some reason, he's on some planet. And he's been falsely accused of spying, and he's accused and convicted. And in this planet, instead of throwing you in jail, what they do is they strap you to a table and implant memories of this horrible prison sentence into your mind. And
And
it
it's like
only takes
20
a few,
years or something, right?
yeah, it
That they
only takes a few
plant.
hours,
Yeah.
but the person experiences, in O'Brien's case, he experiences 20 years in this horrible, brutal prison where he was fighting for existence and suffering and starving and, just this terrible, terrible existence. He was, of course, completely innocent, and he was, accused, tried, convicted, and received this 20-year sentence in a matter of just a really a few days, really before the Federation could even do anything about it, to could even so after he's had these 20 years of prison memories implanted in his head, they release him because he's served a sentence, so 7 hours later. But anyway, he goes back to Deep Space Nine and is basically afflicted with post-traumatic stress disorder, as if he had actually spent 20 years in this prison situation. And it doesn't matter that wasn't real at all. His memories of it are so vivid and so real that they're affecting him, and he's having, he's hoarding his food and lashing out at people and having all the classic PTSD symptoms. Gets to the point where he's actually contemplating suicide. And they manage to get through to him and convince him he is human, and yes, he can be helped. And Bashir, give it, at the end, he gets very intensive therapy and eventually, recovers at least enough to function. But of course, he'll never be without these memories now. And so, I mean, it's just it's a horrendous punishment that didn't actually happen, but it might as well have, as far as the person who experienced it had. So that's the whole, it's all in your head, but yeah, it's absolutely real in those circumstances and has long-term effects afterwards.
And of course, Louise,
It's
I'm sure you
also,
know something about the implanting of false memories. They found that people could develop false memories in sort of psychological studies, and that it feels very real to the person,
oh,
even though
yeah.
it was just a kind of a fabrication of like therapy or some kind of manipulation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It can become very hard to distinguish false memories from true ones if you're really conditioned to believe certain things.
And it's interesting to me that they basically choose psychological torture when they could create anything, right? If the point is, oh, this is much more effective in terms of we're not filling up prisons and having to run, spending resources on running a prison and like wasting a person's whole life, like we're not, because they can like be rehabilitated and go back out into society. And yet it's completely penal and not rehabilitative at
Yeah,
all.
that's
They
exactly right.
could
It's like
have
it
the
just,
technology.
definitely destroys the
If you could
argument
do
that
this,
there's
why
any
would you not
rehabilitative.
like do something that gives someone like all the like 20 years worth of rehabilitation, 20 years worth of like learning the rules of their society? You could brainwash them and make them like actually productive members of your society if you want. And fast forward 20 years to like, great, they've done all their learning and they're now ready to be a productive citizen. And instead, you just chose to make it particularly evil because they did this whole thing where he thought he had a cellmate whom he killed for food and lying and like, and that's especially what really gets at him, not just the imprisonment, but like that I betrayed this friend of mine while we were, and it's just like, why would you people make that up? It's not a good, once again, we talked about last time, the justice system and how messed up it is, that it's like, you could do anything with magic too, and you choose dementors to psychologically torture people. Like, you had so many options for your justice system with this technology, and you chose evil.
And what a wonderful, not wonderful so much, but what an insightful, thought-provoking comment on the way we think about, our penal system and what it's for and what it does, and really tries to drive to the heart of some of the motivations, which is to punish and which is to seek to cause the kind of suffering on the person who perpetrated the crime that onto the victims of the crime perpetrated, or to their families, or to whatever, and it's retribution,
Yes, vengeance.
It is this wonderful tool. That's why I always argue Star Trek is so thought provoking. I love Star Wars. I love Harry Potter. They're all so mythic and they make you, feel woozy goozy. But Star Trek makes you think. It really makes you think, and it doesn't. It makes you think about your own society and your own culture. And I was just going to mention, I think in the 90s when this was coming out, Louise, that notion that there are such things as false memories was much less understood. And in the 1990s, and I'll just give a plug to Eddie Guillemot, who was one of the scholars who wrote one of the chapters in our Star Trek anthology. He wrote about the way that 90s conspiracy culture informs Star Trek, specifically Star Trek Voyager, and but I think you see it in other kinds of Star Trek from that era, which of course Deep Space Nine is. And you see the show wrestling with these really understood, psychological concepts, such as the power of memory and the unreliability of memory, and it is really fascinating.
I think it was also a commentary on, wrongful convictions. And okay, well, so someone gets exonerated after 25, 30 years in jail. Is there any way that you can actually undo that or make up for that? And of course,
I
there
feel like we're going to be falling back into our earlier episodes on memory, which
is.
were so thought-provoking because I'm also now thinking about mind melds and how those are used. And this takes me back to all the stuff we talked about with like Obliviate and memory and how, and the Pensieve and how mind melds are maybe like connected to that too. But we should probably go on to your other example, Louise, of the more positive example of this.
But way to bring in Harry Potter.
I'm bringing it back. It's coming back to the start, the ideas of the mind in both of these, and magic and science fiction to explore the psyche.
Well, and how porous is the mind to these technologies slash magic, and is that okay? The idea that your mind is maybe not like a closed off sanctuary that belongs only to
I
yourself.
mean, doesn't Geordi LaForge effectively get like imperiused by Romulans at one point? He gets like brainwashed.
I don't remember, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, I mean, of
There are
course,
lots of things where people get like taken over by an
Geordi.
alien, like their body is taken over by an alien at some point, right? This happens so many times
Yeah, how
throughout
about
Star
those
Trek.
aliens in the back of the neck?
It's like there are so many different examples of like, oh, that person's acting really weird because some other kind of alien has possessed them. Like, it's the Imperius curse.
And of course, what this example and then the next one I'm going to talk about both also bring in that I think the Cage did not is the idea of time. There's another issue with for O'Brien, 20 years pass during this treatment session. For the rest of us, it's only a few hours, and so you are left with those 20 years worth of memories. You experience and remember them, even though they don't the even but you haven't aged actually during any of that time. So yeah, so the second example was an episode of The Next Generation. It's called The Inner Light. It's one of the most critically acclaimed episodes out there. I think Patrick Stewart said it was his favorite of all the episodes he filmed. It is about, so the Enterprise comes across the space probe, and they I guess they bring it aboard the ship when they're examining it, and Picard gets zapped by it in some way and knocked out. He wakes up in this world where he is being told that his name is Kameen and that he lives on this planet and he has this profession. I don't remember all the details, but he's remembering, no, I'm Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the Enterprise. And they're telling him, no, you've been sick, you've had a fever, all that was a dream. This is your reality. This is your life here. Your name is Kameen, and you do this, and this is your wife, and this is your best friend, and so forth and so forth. You know, that stuff you're dreaming about a spaceship, that's all just part of this fever. So Picard, really, because he has no choice, just sort of goes along with it and starts living this life as Kameen, and has, you know, decades of life in this society where he has a wife and eventually children and grandchildren, and learns to play a flute, and you know, ages, outlives his wife, outlives his friends, but is at the end he's with his grandson, and he is realizing that he's on this planet whose sun's about to go nova. And he's trying to report this to the government, and he finds out, okay, the government knows, but they know that the planet is going to die when the sun explodes, and there's nothing they can do about it because they don't have the technology to leave their world. But they decide they're going to make this probe and preserve their culture and send it out into space and hope that someone will find it someday so that there will be a record of their society and their civilization. And right at the very end, as you know, the sky is lighting up and the sun's about to burst, Picard realizes, oh, I'm not Kamen, I'm the person who found the probe. And so he wakes up. It's only been about 25 minutes for the Enterprise people, but again, Picard has lived decades, and in his case, he lived a very happy life with, you know, all these things that the real Picard didn't have, like a wife and kids and a home, you know, and all this type of stuff. And he wakes up and he realizes that what he has experienced was what this dying civilization left behind to preserve itself. And they chose to preserve their culture by giving him basically the life experience of kind of an ordinary man in their society.
It's like an anthropologist dream.
And
Yeah, but
so,
I think, I mean, it is really
and
a
in the
lot
probe, of
about
course,
cultural.
is the flute that Picard learned to play. And so he picks it up, and of course he can play it perfectly. And so he, you know, has retained that entire memory and that knowledge of 20 something years of Kamen's life. And now he's the one who is going to record, you know, the fact that this society once existed, and you know, sort of preserve their heritage.
Yeah, I think so
And
much of it is about cultural preservation, and and that's very poignant, I think, today too, when you have a lot of like globalism and a lot of the uniqueness of various cultures dying out as generations don't pass along traditions, language, but also like musical forms and so on. And so I thought that was very poignant to have them, try to get somebody from the outside who would be able to appreciate it and carry on just the memory of it into the present and the future.
So, but when you think about it, I mean, they basically did to Picard the exact same thing this other planet did to O'Brien, and neither one of them bothered to ask for consent. Again, another consent problem, just like Harry Potter has sometimes. But, you know, in Picard's case, it was this very positive experience that gave him this gift of this life that he had never known. And this ability to appreciate this music and all this type of stuff. Whereas for O'Brien, of course, it was torture and punishment.
But initially for Picard, it is very unsettling because he doesn't know where he is. And he's thinking, like, you know, he's been taken away from, he's been abducted in his mind from his, literally in his mind, in his point of view, from his life on the Enterprise. And he's forced to be there until he eventually starts to accept it as reality. But initially, it's like, what kind of, when I think once he starts to, A, just become acclimated to it, B, realize it's not nefarious. But initially, it's very uncomfortable. He's like, I don't know who this woman is who's saying she's my wife. And
Right, he's
I don't
still
want to
Jean-Luc
stay on this.
Picard.
You know, a big thing about Picard's whole character is that, like, he didn't want to stay on Earth like his brother did and, like, run the family vineyard. He wanted to go out to the stars, and he's very ambitious, and it's never enough for him. And the idea of, like, oh, I'm supposed to, like, live in this little planet and not, you know, contact my ship and go out and explore is upsetting to him initially. But through time, he comes to, you know, have an appreciation for the life he has there, but it is forced on him.
Yeah,
Yeah,
you
and
just
then
want to reassure him and be like, Picard, you're laying on the carpet on the bridge. You're good. You're good, dude.
it's
Just
only been
lay
five
back. Just
seconds.
enjoy it. Just
You
enjoy
know,
your
and
life. Enjoy your kids. Enjoy your flute.
the implanting of false memories again is making me think about, like, when that can be used to trick people, and I'm thinking about, you know, Voldemort using Harry
Yeah, I was
and
thinking
their
that same
connection
thing with the
to
Ministry of
trick him
Magic.
to come to the Department of Mysteries.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was thinking too that when you think about the end of that episode, I mean, it's bittersweet for Picard. It's not like he's just like, I've had a happy experience, right? He's actually had kind of a you know, deeply moving, troubling
Well, I
even
mean, he
experience.
formed relationships with all of these
Right.
people,
Yeah, he saw like his friend and his wife die. He saw like that
yeah.
whole planet was going to die, and his like children and grandchildren were all going to be
And so all
destroyed.
these people who are real to him, he wakes up and realizes they've been dead for 1,000 years. And I think it's all part of it is also he realizes what he's given up. He turned out he liked having a wife and kids and grandkids and stuff like that. And his current lifestyle is not going to ever get him that.
He gets it in the Nexus.
No, I was gonna say
No?
no, I hate it. I hate it because I don't think Picard ever really wanted that for himself. He made choices. He never really liked being around kids that much. He had his legacy was the people who served under him were people like Wesley, who was effectively his child.
Well, and
So
how about his romance with Vash? I mean, do you remember that? Like, first of all, he's in a romance with a woman whose name means cow in French, so I never got that.
That
However,
never occurred to me.
yeah, it's not a good choice. But anyway, but she's like an adventurer and she's tricky, and like that's not a guy who wants to settle down and have a lot of
I don't think he
grandkids
does, so I really don't like the whole implication of
eventually.
Picard of like, oh, your life is not full, no matter how many times you saved the galaxy and how great a career you had and how many deep relationships you had with people, unless you had a biological offspring, even if you never raised that offspring at all.
Yeah,
So I have
Picard
a lot
kind
of
of
feelings about
reinforces
secret
that.
children. What was that, Emily?
Yep, the Picard series really kind of reinforces that as well, because it's
No,
like,
that's
oh,
exactly my point. And also, how many different secret children are there on Star Trek? They did it with Kirk, then they tried to fake, they did it with Worf, then they fake did it with Picard at the end of TNG, and then real did it with Picard on Picard. And I just really, really hate the trope because I think
Chakotay,
it's,
secret chill.
this is like my hot take here. I hate like the male fantasy that, like, oh, look, you have a legacy that you didn't actually have to raise at all. And now that all the like diapers and the difficult stuff is done and the woman went and raised it and
Sowing
you
the
had
wild
no
oats.
guilt. And like, you can blame the woman
And
for not
yet,
telling you the truth, but you were able to live your whole life without having to raise a child, but now get the benefit of having a child to
right, your
carry on your
immortality is
legacy.
secured with
Yeah, I
none of
hate it.
us.
I hate it. I hate it on multiple levels. I hate it on a gender level. I hate it on a level of like your life was not complete unless you had children, but only in the way that you didn't actually have to do any of the dirty work that the wife or mother or woman in the had to do. So
And
don't even
how about the like cheeky
Perhaps we should
plot
relate
twist?
this to Cursed Child now.
Yes,
Voldemort had
yes.
his child that he didn't have to
No.
raise either.
Oh,
Yeah. And
yeah.
also, we don't need every story of everyone having, like, you know, become an adult, got married, and have 2.5 children, or they're not like a real person.
Yeah. Okay.
But
Amen. Amen.
I would like to talk about another example of memories that, like, or not even memories of not real experience that can be positive, which is Nog on Deep Space Nine in the episode "It's Only a Paper Moon" in season seven, where Nog lost his leg, spoilers, during a battle, and because it's the Star Trek future, he's able to, get a good replacement leg that you really can't even notice the difference. And Star Trek, because of the episodic nature of it and because of the technology, tends to not linger on trauma that long after an episode, because it's just, well, we got to move on to the next thing, and we're not going to now spend the rest of the season talking about how traumatized this person is when they're not going to have another traumatic experience 2 days later. O'Brien, I'm looking at you. Poor guy. It's like a one O'Brien suffers episode after another.
I
It's
do
just,
love him though. He suffers very well.
I
Yeah.
know.
Poor guy. Poor guy. Justice
Aww.
for O'Brien. But when Nog loses his leg, they say, yeah, they'll be able to get him a brand new leg and he won't even notice the difference. But he comes back and he's unsettled. He still feels like there's pain in his leg, even though there's no biological reason for there to be pain. And he decides to live for a while on the in the holosuite where Vic Fontaine has his 1960s Las Vegas club. And everyone's debating like whether or not this is a good thing for him. On the one hand, he like needs a little bit of time away, but then he's living a whole life there and refusing to come out at all because he like can't cope with the real world. And there's this whole level that has to be decided of like, at what point is it healthy for him to have an escape for a while and not be in the real world? And when is it you need to go out and face the real world at some point? You can't hide here forever. But for him, this is, the closest to reality he wants to get. And it's, called "It's Only a Paper Moon," because it's not, it to a certain extent it can help heal him, but he can't live
That's
in it
like that
forever.
dwelling on dreams and forgetting to live quote, right? There's a
Exactly.
yeah, there's
So
a
he needs
kind of
like the right level of that therapeutic, catharsis to realize that he doesn't need the walking stick he's been using. He, needed that distraction to feel safe enough to forget about his leg. But it really comes down to his fear of dying and what else could happen to him. It's not the fact that he lost his leg, because he doesn't have to live, quote unquote, disabled. He's able to get a replacement leg that's good as new, can't tell the difference, can't feel the difference, but he's always going to have that memory of what it was like to lose his leg and to fear what else could happen to me. I could die in battle. Anything could happen.
And Vic's role, because Vic takes a leading role when other people can't convince him to come
And Vic is
out.
not a real person.
Vic takes the leading role in trying to coax him out and to get him past this inability to process what's happened to him and process and move past it. And this so reminds me of when Harry goes to nearly headless Nick, and
I hadn't
says
thought of
to him,
that.
oh, after Sirius dies, what was he going to be a ghost? Is he going to, can you like bring him over here? Like, can we have another party with the ghost? Can I see him? And I mean, he doesn't quite ask all those questions, but you can tell he's kind of going there, right? And Nick knows he's going there too. And Nick's like, oh no, oh, not this again, And Nick says these things that have to be hard for someone who chose to be a ghost, which is to basically say, people who choose to be ghosts are kind of cowardly. It's kind of a cowardly choice. It's not the right choice. It's not the choice that you're going to make, Harry Potter, because you're Harry Potter, And it's
And
such a
it's not the choice
similar.
Sirius would have made.
Exactly. That's
And
exactly it.
it's not like it's not living in a reality in a way. It's sort of right. It's sort of like
You
it's
can't
in a
eat food. You can't smell.
you're in
So your
limbo.
sensations aren't there. And it's
You're
almost
neither
like
one
being a
place or the
photonic
other.
being. Like Vic Fontaine, right?
Right. Or the
Who,
doctor on Voyager, right?
And these are people who, not people, beings who crave humanity to some extent. And even Vic says, like, this is my life here because this is all I have because I was made this way because, I'm made of light. I'm a fictional character. This is what I've got. But then they also recognize him as so real that they all have to help him when there's the whole thing, bada bing, bada bang. When I'm just saying sounds, that's the episode name. When the club gets taken over because there's this hidden level basically of the holosuite game, and everyone's like, well, we have to go help him even because he's our friend, even if he's fictional.
I know. Well, and the same with the doctor as well. The doctor is trusted so much, again, spoiler alert, that he becomes eventually the emergency command hologram, or at least has the capability to be that. How many times has he saved the ship, because he's a hollow made of light. he's a hologram.
Yeah, I think this holodeck stuff is also really interesting in the realm of, reality versus dreaming or fantasy. And it's interesting how often they'll do like a whole episode in the holodeck where they're, I don't know, like Robin Hood or whatever, right? I mean, they have
Oh,
all
with the one
kinds
with
of
Q and Vash,
they have all kinds of, episodes like that where they're sort of, it gives them an, like, in terms of the plot, it allows them to play with, some different things, but it also suggests that, even in this very technologically sophisticated, scientific realm, there the importance of play and escape and fantasy worlds that you can disappear into for a while is still valued. And I think that's really
And of
interesting.
course, there was one of those on the original series too. There was that whole planet where you could go to play, and Kirk got to beat up his old enemy from the academy, and
Giant rabbits, I think.
yeah, giant rabbits. Yeah, you could basically have anything you want, surely on shore leave. You can just go in and enjoy this fantasy world.
Yeah, just try to think nice thoughts on that planet. I seem to remember that being the case.
And another Next Generation episode, now that you brought to mind, hadn't thought about in years, is the Casino Royale one, where they,
Oh, the Royale.
that where they find themselves in that cheesy Vegas hotel where this cosmonaut had crash landed, and all the aliens again had was this one trashy novel, and they assumed, oh, this is the type of life he wants, and so they, created this entire cheesy hotel with all
Which was
these.
kind of an attempt at kindness to make him
He was
feel
trying to take
comfortable.
care of him, and
Yeah,
of course
creating a
he's written in
habitat.
his diary that says, these characters are so trite, and this whole thing is so stupid. I will welcome death when it comes.
God, I will
I'm
welcome
also
death.
thinking
That's not a
about
tribute.
the episode Hollow Pursuits. It is called Hollow Pursuits with Lieutenant Barclay, who kind of struggles to fit in on the Enterprise, and he likes to spend all his time in the holodeck, but it gets kind of like inappropriate when he starts using his colleagues in the
Oh, yeah.
holodeck. And
Starts
again,
it
there's that
always
lovely line,
does. Deanna
how much
Troi.
of this is healthy and how much of it is not? And should you be
Which.
allowed to use your colleagues in a holodeck program? Feels like no.
Oh, Barclay. I love
Well, I
Barclay.
mean, I'm also thinking of that Voyager one with the Hirogen, where they're in World War II, like Nazi-occupied
Yeah,
France,
that's
and the
powerful.
Voyager crew like thinks that's where they live for real, and like have to break out of the holodeck.
Yeah, right, because they've kind of modified their memories. Speaking of, stuff that crosses over with Harry Potter, they've modified their memories so that they are convinced that this is their real context, historical context. And so, that's a all that stuff with the Hirogens and the way that they want that holodeck technology, in order to do their hunting. Oh, anyway, I could go on. I won't.
Yeah, I was sort of thinking about, there's that old Chinese saying, is I think it's I tried to look it up. I'm probably going to mispronounce it. Zhuangzi, who says, that he dreamed he was a butterfly, and then he when he woke up, he has this question, well, was I a man dreaming of a butterfly, or am I a butterfly dreaming I'm a man?
This makes me think also, okay, we got to talk about Moriarty for a second on TNG, where in season two, Elementary, My Dear Data, where Data has a holodeck program where he's Sherlock Holmes and he wants a Moriarty that can like actually be good enough to go up against him, and he gets saved in the computer and then comes back several seasons later, and they have to trick him into thinking that he's off the holodeck when he's still on the holodeck, and they get tricked into thinking that they're off the holodeck when they're still in the holodeck, and no one knows where they really are. And then they make this statement at the end where they've like saved him onto the self-existing hard drive, that like, what if we're all just like in a box on a table somewhere playing out fantasies?
Yeah, which of course, if you've got the DVD at home, they are.
Right.
Oh yeah, so
They are.
so yeah, so
Same with
but
like Far Beyond the, we have to talk about Far Beyond the Stars, Deep
well, I was
Space
going to say
Nine.
that Zhuangzi quote, like that's from the 4th century BC, so
Right,
this is some sort
right.
of perpetual
Yeah,
human.
Benny Sisko, he's the dreamer and the dream.
Yeah, like there's something that's just a fundamental human wonder about this whole thing. Well, thank you so much, Louise, for sharing your thoughts with us in your owl post to us, and we're so glad you were able to come on the episode to talk with us directly about it.
Well, thank you for asking me. It's a lot of fun. Always enjoy talking Trek and also always enjoy talking Potter. So,
Yeah, how much fun to see that particular connection playing out in the two different series. Listeners, if you have thoughts about today's episode or any other episodes that you have listened to, please do write to us at pottervercitypodcast@gmail.com, and maybe we can include your comment on a future Owlpost episode. Well, for our closing quote, I'm not going to do anything unexpected here. Let's go with the classic. In the limbo realm of King's Cross Station, Harry asks Dumbledore, "Is this real, or has this been happening inside my head?" To which Dumbledore replies, "Of course it's happening inside your head, Harry, but why on earth should that mean it's not real?" Keep dreaming and keep it real, listeners.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to pottervercitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.